Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Gregory Gause, the Department Chair and Professor of Political Science at the University of Vermont. He's the author of The International Relations of the Persian Gulf, Oil Monarchies, Domestic and Security Challenges in the Arab Gulf States, and Saudi-Yemeni Relations, Domestic Structures and Foreign Influence. Previously, he was a Fellow for Arab and Islamic Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. Welcome to Background Briefing, Gregory Gause.
Thank you.
And you've written a lot about the Gulf in terms of its energy supplies. Obviously, it's been the most important part of the world in terms of energy supplies. But that's changing, of course, as the U.S. becomes energy independent through fracking and recovering oil from shale and gas, etc. But the New York Times just ran a front page story saying that China buys nearly half of the oil that Iraq produces, and that, in effect, China has become the biggest beneficiary of the Iraq war. Is that something that it's clear to you?
Yeah, I think that that's been clear for a while. I think that it's one of these great ironies of history. People who opposed the war, and I didn't think the war was a good idea, but people who opposed the war in 2003 saying this is a war for oil, I think misunderstood what the Bush administration was after. If they fought this war for oil, they fought it even worse than we thought. But I don't think they were fighting for oil. I think they were fighting for, surprisingly enough, some larger issues about regional stability and terrorism, their understanding about the origins of terrorism. And frankly, I don't think they spent too much, they didn't spend that much attention on the oil situation. And because of that, and this is probably a good thing, the Iraqi oil sector has developed much more independently of American control than almost anybody imagined back when this war was fought in 2003.
Well, that's not to say though, that some people like Paul Wolfowitz and Doug Feith and others, that the architects of this war, didn't make these extraordinary promises when General Shinseki testified that it would take hundreds of thousands of U.S. troops and a large occupying force. He was dismissed out of hand, and and instead Wolfowitz testified that, oh, you know, this will cost us only, I think it was another official said it would be cost us $60 billion, and it wouldn't be long before Iraq was pumping oil and paying for everything, and everything is going to be hunky-dory. So,
Right. Wolfowitz actually told a congressional committee that this would be a self-financing occupation. And I think that that was just either a colossal misunderstanding or a misrepresentation of the Iraqi oil situation.
Well, in the New York Times article on Monday, the front page, they quote Michael Makovsky, a former Defense Department official in the Bush administration who worked on Iraq oil policy. He's quoted as saying, "We lost out. The Chinese had nothing to do with the war, but from an economic standpoint, they are benefiting from it. And our Fifth Fleet and our Air Forces are helping to assure their supply." So I guess he's opening up a double irony there, is he not? Not just the past in terms of who won the Iraq war, but the present.
Exactly. And I think that this has been an irony. I mean, even before the Iraq war, American naval power and the American political presence in the Gulf, to some extent, one can argue about the details here, but to some extent helped to guarantee the free flow of oil to all sorts of people, including the Chinese. Now the Chinese are, with their own economic growth, are much more aggressive in going out to try to find new sources of energy, whether it be in Africa, sub-Saharan Africa, or in Latin America, or in Iraq. And the reason I think that the Times article made clear, and this is, I think, the real story here, is that the Chinese oil companies, unlike, say, ExxonMobil or BP, are direct arms of the Chinese state. So they can go in and take deals that perhaps are not as profitable in the short term, but gives China kind of a foot in the door to this rebirth of the Iraqi oil industry. The kinds of deals that ExxonMobil and BP and Shell won't take because the return on investment is not what they're looking for.
So when the Iraqi oil company basically wants 90% and the Chinese will settle for 5-3% profits, which ExxonMobil won't touch because they need 20 or 25% return for their shareholders. So what's going on with Iraq, though? Because there's obviously a lot of political division there, and the Sunni are extremely restless. The Kurds are all but autonomous and making separate oil deals. The government, my understanding is al-Maliki's government isn't sharing the revenues, particularly with the Sunni and the Kurds. So what is the accounting that's going on there in terms of the 90% that the Iraqi government coffers are getting?
Right. And there are a couple of issues here. The first one let's take is the relationship between the Kurds and the central government. The central government actually is paying into the Kurdish regional government's budget, according to kind of these are not even constitutional agreements. They're kind of the precedents established when the Saddam regime fell and the United States was setting up the first Iraqi post-Saddam government. The government in Baghdad still pays in about 16%, 17%, somewhere in there, of its oil revenues to the Kurdish regional government. And that hasn't stopped. The big fight is whether the Kurdish regional government should be able to negotiate its own oil deals in its own territory. It has asserted the right to do that and has signed deals with all sorts of international oil companies, including recently ExxonMobil. The government in Baghdad and the United States government, for that matter, say, no, these deals are not legal. All oil deals have to go through Baghdad. And that's an issue of contention, one of the major issues of contention. There are others between the Kurdish regional government and Baghdad. In terms of the tension between Iraqi Sunnis, many of whom feel cut out by this government, it's not so much an oil issue because the oil is basically in the south, although there's some around Kirkuk. But it's basically the big oil is in the south. And that's an overwhelmingly Shia area. So it's not a Sunni-Shia thing so much as it's an oil development issue. And there we get into the balance of power between the international oil companies and the government in Baghdad. The government in Baghdad desperately needs capital. It's not like Kuwait or Saudi Arabia that have their own capital, plenty of money in the bank, and can finance their own oil field development and maintenance. Right? The Iraqi government needs to get capital, and that's what the big oil companies can bring. They bring technology too, but mostly what they bring is capital. But the Iraqis don't want to give the outside oil companies control over their reserves. They want to maintain control. So they want to sign deals that are in the business are called production sharing agreements. In other words, the Iraqi government maintains legal control over all the reserves, but the international oil companies are willing to take a percentage or to be paid a fixed fee for every barrel of oil that they bring out of the ground. And so that's actually not even production sharing. That's a service contract. What the big Western companies have wanted is a production sharing. They want a formal share of the production. The Chinese are willing to do these kind of fee per barrel deals, service contracts, much more readily than the Western oil companies are. And that's why they're the preferred partner for the Iraqis right now.
Again, I'm speaking with Gregory Gores, who's the department chair and professor of political science at the University of Vermont. He's the author of The International Relations of the Persian Gulf, Oil Monarchies, Domestic and Security Challenges in the Arab Gulf States, and Saudi-Yemeni Relations, Domestic Structures and Foreign Influence. So when the Iraqis are saying that they basically need about $30 billion in investment to really take advantage of their tremendous reserves, already they're the second biggest oil supplier from the Gulf, are they not?
Yes. Their production, which for decades was pretty low, below 3 million barrels a day because of Saddam Hussein's invasion of Kuwait, the sanctions, and then the American invasion, was below, the Iraqis were below Iranian production. They have now recovered, and they've gotten above Iranian production.
But
so they're number two in the Gulf, after Saudi Arabia, which is far and away the largest producer.
Right, but with the, if they got the $30 billion that they feel the oil fields need to be brought up to capacity, where would they be then?
Oh, well, in their most ambitious plans, they talk about equaling Saudi production, getting up to 9 or 10 million barrels a day from about the 3, 3.5 where they are now. That is probably not in the cards. But they could certainly get up to 5 or 6 if they get that kind of investment.
So what's going on then, Gregory Gores? My understanding from talking to former CIA officials who know that region, that Iran is breaking its oil embargo imposed by the Europeans and the United States because of its nuclear program, that they're basically selling their oil through Iraq.
I don't doubt that there's some oil going from Iran into Iraq, but even with that embargo from the U.S., which, of course, that embargo on the, from the U.S. has been since 1979, more recently from the EU, the Iranians have plenty of customers, and the Chinese being, you know, one of the primary ones. So I don't think the Iranians are having trouble finding customers for their oil. The sanctions are the other economic sanctions are biting the Iranians in other ways, but there are still customers for Iranian oil.
And they're discounting it, aren't they? And the Chinese are doing barter agreements. I believe that almost every consumer good in Iran comes from China.
I wouldn't be surprised at that at all. Although I don't have information on specific barter deals, the Iranians, of course, have been looking east economically for decades since the revolution, and the Chinese not only have a real appetite to buy energy, but they are also a major exporter now, and they're looking to export. They don't only export to us.
So, Gregory Gores, just in terms of this big shift underway, my understanding is that the global energy markets are undergoing a massive change, a tectonic change that's taking place, largely driven by the United States. And in spite of the fact that over the decades, every American president has said we've become energy independent, and of course, during those decades, we've become more and more dependent on Persian Gulf or whatever you want to call the Gulf,
right.
Let's call it Gulf oil, that all of these presidents have promised it. And in fact, the opposite's happened. We've become more and more dependent. But this president, Obama, who promised the same thing, is actually delivering that we are really changing enormously, in part due to bringing all this gas online through this controversial process called fracking and also the Canadian tar sands development, et cetera. So how come this has sort of gone somewhat under the radar, this revolutionary change?
Well, I think that it's certainly an important change. How important, I think, remains to be seen. Some of the more optimistic or even cheerleader-like analyses of how the American domestic energy production sector are going to change, I think, have to be taken with a grain of salt. And when we look at overall the world energy picture, we shouldn't just focus on the supply side. Without a doubt, the development of new energy resources in North America are going to change the supply side of the world energy market. Of course, we're setting aside the whole question of whether burning these fossil fuels that are coming out in from North America is a good idea or not. We'll just set that one aside for now. But the other side of this equation is demand, right? Will demand growth in South Asia, Southeast Asia, China, grow at such a rate that that this new energy coming into the market from North America will basically just keep things kind of even? That is to say, we've had 10 years of an enormous run-up in energy prices, oil prices. Natural gas, we've seen a leveling off and even a decrease. But in oil prices, remember 10 years ago, 2003, oil prices were probably in the 20s, $20 per barrel. Now, for Brent crude, they're up around $100 a barrel. For West Texas Intermediate crude, they're around $90 a barrel. And so we've seen an enormous run-up in energy prices driven to some extent by political events like the Iraq invasion, but more fundamentally by drastically increased demand from China and India and other Asian markets. So I think we have to also look at the demand side in Asia. If Asian growth continues to grow at a healthy pace, right, we might see oil prices level off, but maybe not go down that much. And thus the whole idea of kind of the energy revolution in the United States and Canada might not bring about as big a change in the energy markets as some people are estimating right now.
Well, one of the figures that I've seen is that the United States will surpass Russia next year as the world's biggest supplier of natural gas.
I wouldn't be surprised at that at all. I mean, of course, you know, if we go back even further, the United States was for decades the major producer of oil, the major producer of energy in the entire world. And to this day, we're still, a hugely important, even without the recent revolution in energy discovery and production, we've always been a major producer of energy.
Well, that was one of the great ironies, wasn't it? During the 50s and 60s, it was the Texas lobby that insisted on the U.S. using its domestic supply when Saudi oil would have, I think he could have got it for 5 cents a barrel or something
right.
ridiculous.
Right. It was a drain America first policy.
Right. And we
did.
We did. Right. So, but are we likely to shift, though, away from gas in the car, petroleum in the car, and in trucks, which are a huge part of the transportation infrastructure?
Right.
I know they're switching to hybrids, but isn't it likely that we'll switch to natural gas? Because a lot of other countries, for example, in Australia, when you go to a gas station, you can either have gasoline or compressed or liquefied natural gas, and the price for gas is always a lot cheaper, and it's about 50% less in terms of pollution of CO2.
I wouldn't be at all surprised to see that change. Obviously, that's a huge infrastructure investment in our kind of the delivery systems, right, in our gas stations. But it can be done, and to the extent that we develop our gas resources even more dramatically than we're developing our oil resources, I would definitely think that would be a kind of change that we would see. Now, whether that kind of technological change would come to the growth markets of South and East Asia, which is where Persian Gulf oil really is headed, not so much to our markets, but east. That would be the big question for the the oil producers in the Gulf region.
Well, just in closing there, Gregor Gass, there's also another big question that looms, and that is, what is fracking doing to the aquifers? And a lot of people are extremely alarmed about fracking in general. It's the French have banned it, and I think Britain just removed its moratorium, but there's a great deal of concern about it.
And I think that there will be more concern in the United States the more we do. And so I think that people who draw a straight line from our current level of gas production resulting from fracking just straight out aren't taking into account what could be the backlash against fracking as we understand the other consequences that it brings about.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Gregor Gass.
My pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Gregor Gass, who is the Department Chair and Professor of Political Science at the University of Vermont. He's the author of The International Relations of the Persian Gulf, Oil Monarchies, Domestic and Security Challenges in the Arab Gulf States, and Saudi-Yemeni Relations, Domestic Structures and Foreign Influence. Previously, he was a fellow for Arab and Islamic Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about the Republicans' unprecedented use of the filibuster.
Conserving energy is everyone's responsibility. Call 4-H to find out how you can do your part.